Welcome to KABU, Lauren Regan.
Thank you, Jan.
Well, you and others at the Civil Liberties Defense Center have for years provided legal representation and trainings for activists and particularly those engaged in direct action and civil disobedience. Well, with the mass protests since the murder of George Floyd in Minnesota on Memorial Day, a movement has arisen around the country and around the world calling for major police reforms, including some demands for defunding or abolishing police departments. So let's start with what you are seeing now in terms of how police themselves are responding to the protests, perhaps beginning with the streets of Portland and Eugene, where you're located.
Well, in terms of what we're observing by law enforcement, you know, number one, we are witnessing some of the most militarized police that we have seen in recent times, paired with an overwhelming, indiscriminate use of illegal force. You know, the standards for the use of force are that a police officer is only allowed to use that amount of force which is reasonably necessary under the circumstances. And in order to use force upon someone, they have to be doing something individualized and specific. For instance, they have to be resisting arrest. They have to be fighting with police, using weapons or brandishing weapons. You know, there has to be something that justifies the use of force.
Doesn't that also include interfering with police being able to carry out their duties? That's, I think, a kind of vague area, but is that included?
In an individualized way, you know, that is true. But there is also the reality that if a large group of people is, you know, for instance, marching in the streets, it is unreasonable for law enforcement to immediately order that entire crowd onto the sidewalk or face, you know, CS gas, tear gas, or rubber bullets or other types of force. You know, there is always a balancing. And it is not a dictatorial situation where law enforcement gets to basically make a decision and then everything else be damned. And so I think that there is a long line of case law that is supposed to form the boundaries of what is reasonable force. You know, when police misconduct and excessive force goes into the courtroom, which, of course, you know, we recognize that that courtroom is itself an entity that is plagued with systemic racism. You know, so I'm not saying that the courtroom is somehow this laboratory of, you know, unbiased neutrality or anything like that. But when federal civil rights actions are filed alleging that law enforcement has violated people's constitutional rights, whether that be hindering First Amendment rights or brutality and excessive force, when it goes into the courtroom, the case law that has been built over decades becomes sort of the boundaries that the judge is supposed to look to guide its decision on whether or not a police officer's actions were reasonable and whether the force used was excessive. And so, you know, we are in pretty unprecedented times right now in terms of the use of militarized police and their weapons and technology that they are using against, you know, activists and people who are taking the streets. And I think often, you know, we hear the term, you know, quote unquote, nonviolent protesters. And I think that that has kind of become a shorthand label to sort of define the majority of people who are showing up to these marches, you know, the majority of people from our community that are showing up in solidarity, they're there to march, they're there to exercise their rights, they're not there to do acts of economic sabotage or property destruction or to, you know, confront and antagonize law enforcement. That is the overwhelming majority of people who are often showing up to these events. But those are also people who are then victimized by the use of tear gas and rubber bullets and whatnot. And when cops come out and use that kind of force on crowds, it causes those folks to rethink whether or not they're going to leave their homes and come and join in those protests.
I mean, this is a tactic of the police and the state for repression. Absolutely. It's not just rogue cops. Can we talk some about the point you're making, the legal grounds police have for more aggressive or violent tactics? And one of the grounds is what's called reasonable fear, and that's been part of the demands for reform, is challenging this stance where police can say, I felt a fear or threat in my life. And now, of course, in a way, the police do have a reasonable fear, because there's discussion of, you know, there are mass protests on the streets and many calling for abolishing many of these institutions. Can you talk about that issue of reasonable fear and how it's worked in policing and how it's been challenged now?
Well, I think that is an issue that at its core is also about state power and state control, because the state creates a narrative that it disseminates that justifies the notion that cops should be afraid of us. We're afraid of cops. You know, that whole narrative was created by the institutions that then perpetuate that violence. You know, I think it's too easy, you know, to basically say that, you know, that the use of force by law enforcement, you know, is reasonable because people are chanting ACAB, for instance. The law says that as trained public servants who are given the power to kill other humans, you know, law enforcement is one of the only professions in the world that, when licensed, is licensed to kill other humans.
Like the military.
Yeah, but even more so, I think, because police are supposed to be working with civilian populations, not on a battlefield. You know, there is almost more consent when you're talking about soldiers in a war zone, though I will note that, like, the Geneva Conventions actually forbid the use of chemical weapons on battlefields, you know, unlike in our streets, as we are all, you know, being forced to suck up tear gas while a respiratory pandemic is going on. So I would say there's even a heightened duty with regard to law enforcement.
And you're talking in part about the position of the police as an agent of the state, and you mentioned that several times. How important do you think it is, the analysis of the police itself and how we understand policing as an institution and as an instrument of the state versus the most direct and immediate and visible display of police brutality on the streets?
Well, I think, again, you know, the state and its power to manipulate reality and facts and to kind of push a tainted version of the facts to the people is definitely a problem. And I think, you know, as most people know at this point, you know, the origins of policing were basically to hunt down, you know, quote unquote, escaped slaves. And so the origins of the policing system within the U.S. has at its core, you know, racism and discrimination. And, you know, I'm pretty excited to, I would say, like, you know, some parts that are coming up that are somewhat positive, you know, in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, are things like real conversations about defunding police. Law enforcement, police departments, their budgets have only ballooned over the years, where social services, education, you know, and other things have been gutted. And there are a lot of places around the country that are now talking about taking that money and putting it to social services, social work, mental health, you know, community programs that will actually keep everyone in a community safer. And I think that is a good starting point. I think there are some police departments like that in Minneapolis that are, you know, under threat of being disbanded, you know, something that we never thought, you know, we would hear during the Trump regime, you know, people actually completely abolishing law enforcement. But these are, you know, these are conversations that are long overdue. You know, many of us have been talking about that for a long time, and we're told that it was, you know, fantasy land to be talking about that. And so this is an opening, you know, this is a moment in time, a historic moment where people need to take advantage of it. And I don't mean that in a weird way. You know, I mean that, you know, now is the time to be looking at, you know, like just for instance, here in Eugene, we realized that Eugene police policy actually not only had a carotid neck restraint that was permissible, but it was actually more expensive than that in Minneapolis. And as a result of the times that we are in, the city of Eugene just quote unquote suspended and hopefully will repeal that policy for law enforcement. So local levels, you know, are always really important when it comes to police misconduct, you know, and citizen police accountability. Now is the time for everybody, regardless of where they live, to be digging in, you know, to the work that needs to be done in order to make their communities more safe from police misconduct and police brutality.
Lauren, what you've been working for a very long time on the climate movement, activists engaged in civil disobedience and other forms of direct action that also raise the question of how marginalized communities, communities of color, have suffered the worst effects of that crisis, as well as the pandemic and the economic crises that we're living through. How do you see this movement we're in now around policing extending into or furthering a conversation around the climate emergency and its impact on marginalized communities?
Well, I think right now this movement is centered on Black and communities of color. It is led by those communities, and that is important and needs to be respected. You know, I think that personally, we know and understand that many people who are suffering from environmental injustice, you know, and the worst consequences of climate change do tend to be communities of color and poor communities. And so there is very much crossover between, you know, issues regarding climate and issues regarding race and economic status, you know, and things of that nature. So they are definitely related, but you know, I would just say that as, you know, as a white lawyer, it is certainly not my position to be asserting climate activism into this movement that is being led by POC communities.
But perhaps this is part of conversations we have to have or hope to have over time, and what it means to build a more caring and life-sustaining society and world. So hopefully that can be continue to be part of those conversations over time. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, the reality right now with the climate crisis, you know, is that scientists, without caring about what color skin a person has, are predicting that, you know, in approximately 10 years, there is no turning back from climate change. And we also know that industrialized countries, countries with economic privilege, are the biggest contributors to it and will likely be the most resilient to it as well. And so just like the issue of drinking water and having safe water to drink, fighting climate change and fighting the impacts from climate change, including where are you going to get your food and where are you going to get clean water? You know, those are issues that affect everyone. And hopefully, you know, there can be some unification, you know, around different social movements and environmental movements, where we do realize that, you know, what unites us is stronger than what divides us. And that, you know, at some point we, the people, will have to come together against the profiteering corporations that literally have their knee on our necks. You know, I mean, there is definitely some analogy between what's going on now and the broader climate movement. But I also think that, you know, we have seen around the world fossil fuel companies or other giant profiteering corporations and industries participating in extrajudicial assassinations and killing of activists to silence them. So you don't need, you know, state power or state authorization to harass or terrorize civilian populations and activists. You know, that has been something that in other parts of the world, activists have dealt with for a very long time.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken talking with Lauren Regan with the Civil Liberties Defense Center, Eugene, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Jen, and I hope everybody stays safe and healthy.
You as well.